Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, more on how the highway lobby destroyed mass transit for fun and profit, and the high price the rest of us are paying for it. It's a documentary titled Taken for a Ride. I hope you'll stay tuned. Last week, we heard the first half of a documentary film. It's by Jim Klein, and its title is Taken for a Ride, adapted to radio by yours truly. In the 20th century, General Motors, headed by Alfred P. Sloan, bought up, quickly milked to death, and shut down America's clean, efficient, light rail transit systems. We heard a lot about that last week. This week, GM then went on and founded the Highway Lobby, with a little help from its friends. Friends like Firestone, DuPont, and Standard Oil. As a result, America now has almost no passenger rail service, and our cities have 16-lane freeways through the heart of town. No more trolley lines, and massive traffic jams and air pollution. Today we'll hear the history of the highway lobby and its ongoing war to pour more concrete everywhere and rip up any light rail tracks they somehow missed. Art is long and a half hour is short, so let's segue back to Taken for a Ride.
Will you stop honking, Mac? We ain't going nowhere.
This is Agony Alley. Morning rush and evening wait. What's a citizen gonna do?
Don't honk your horn. Raise your voice. Ask for better highways and more parking space.
It's your country. Give yourself the green light.
How did General Motors influence highway lobby in Washington?
Well, influence. I mean, they originated it. I mean, in June 1932, Sloan, chairman of General Motors, created something called the National Highway Users Conference. He brought together the oil companies, the tire companies, anyone who had anything to do with motorized transportation, brought them into this tremendous umbrella group. This became the kernel of what we now know as the highway lobby. They would spend millions and millions of dollars on pushing highways.
Now let me say a word about government bureaucracy.
Alfred Sloan headed the National Highway Users Conference for 20 years. When he retired, the next GM president took his place. Everyone wanted freeways. At the top of General Motors' agenda was a system that would not only move people between cities, but would also become the main form of travel within them. With an army of paid lobbyists and an unlimited war chest, the highway lobby was by far the most powerful pressure group in Washington.
Freedom to travel safely and quickly and comfortably on our highways is not a little freedom, but a big one. People in their own communities are getting together to do something.
I'm Helen Rathburn, the fourth grade teacher at the new elementary school. I came here today just to listen. I didn't expect to say anything. But after hearing some of the arguments against the new highway proposal, I would like to say just one thing. I work all day with children, and they're your children. Your children will have a better country to live in because of these new roads. Can't you see that this highway means a whole new way of life for the children?
GM also had strong allies inside the White House. In 1953, General Motors President Charles Wilson was appointed Secretary of Defense. There, he pushed for freeways as a vital part of national security. That same year, Francis DuPont, whose family owned the largest share of General Motors, became the chief administrator of federal highways.
Did Francis DuPont play much of a role in terms of working towards the interstate system?
He was the key to it. He was the key to it, actually getting it moving. The DuPont name had a great deal of pressure to open a door. He proposed to President Eisenhower that this was a program the nation needed. He immediately got favorable reaction and was told to go ahead.
In 1956, after years of promotional films, industry lobbying, and inside influence, Congress passed the largest public works project in history, the Interstate Highway System. About half the money would build freeways in the cities. To pay for the interstates, Congress created the Highway Trust Fund with money from a gasoline tax. This fund could only be used to build highways. More highways meant more driving. More driving meant more taxes, and more taxes would mean more roads.
O Almighty God, who has given us this earth and has appointed men to have domination over it, who has commanded us to make straight the highways, to lift up the valleys, and to make the mountains low, we ask thy blessing. Bless these, our nation's road builders, and their friends.
This is Highway I-93. It is the final 8-lane southern link of an interstate highway. Building the road required the relocation of 4,000 people, 26 businesses, and part of the Mystic River. And the road has a problem. It doesn't work. It would feed 4 extra lanes of traffic into a 3-lane highway on which traffic already backs up 2 miles during the rush hour.
They were building this freeway along the waterfront in San Francisco. But a funny thing happened along the way. The people of San Francisco said they didn't like the new freeway, and they began protesting.
Joseph Alioto, former mayor of San Francisco.
They wanted to complete the freeway, which was ran along the Embarcadero Center. And I wouldn't let them. They had to get our permission to close the streets. And Governor Reagan sent Lieutenant Governor Finch down to see me. And said, we'll give you the port, we'll give you everything out there if you let us complete this freeway. I says, forget it. We aren't going to let you complete any freeway along our waterfront. Do what you've done in towns like Boston, Seattle, and places like that. It isn't going to happen.
For the 2 years that I was at the Federal Highway Administration, it was a drumbeat of citizen unhappiness with urban highway plans.
In Washington, D.C., this huge freeway, I-95, was going to barrel right through the community I lived in. It was the kind of freeway that actually ended up being almost 26 lanes. It was going to bisect neighborhood after neighborhood and take schools from people, churches from people, universities from people.
We have a street called U Street, which was the street for black folks. They was going to run it right straight down the middle of that street. So that was how we got practically all the inner city people to join us, because we showed their area was going to be uprooted so somebody from outside the city could drive right through.
A freeway by Fisherman's Wharf, and then out to the Marina Greens. It looks out to Sausalito. There isn't a view like that anywhere in this world. Just to get over the Golden Gate Bridge. So I told them, look, just tell everybody to slow up in town and enjoy themselves in this beautiful town. They don't have to zip through it.
Who was pushing this? I mean, okay, oh, you've got those
the road lobby. Builders, the highway lobby,
the cement mixers, the asphalt.
Every year, they had a bag of money, and everybody was getting $50,000, $10,000, the chairman
of the board getting money. The federal trust.
It's not our government. It doesn't belong to us because we haven't paid enough for it. The people who own the government have bought it and paid for it.
That highway crowd, if you gave them a chance, they would put a freeway right through the Vatican if they figured by doing it that they would save a little space or save a little mileage.
We heard from New York, West Side Highway, New Orleans, Nashville, Atlanta was a big fight, Newport, California, Phoenix, And at one point, we were putting up people from Wheeling, West Virginia. And while they were in Washington and we were helping them go downtown and plead their case in Congress, their homes were bulldozed that very day. This was a brutal period in our history, a very brutal period.
Citizens worked together to stop 17 urban freeways across the country. But most of the highways were built as planned.
Sooner or later, the collective mind is going to put this together, and then there is going to be a collective political will, and then it is going to change, and they are going to say, we are not going to fund this foolishness anymore, because it's very foolish.
Urban theorist Lewis Mumford.
The motor car shapes and forms, mutilates and deforms might be better words.
We are exchanging the meaningful and varied life of the city for an increasingly monotonous life on wheels.
The choice is clear and urgent. Does the city exist for people or for motor cars?
By the mid-60s, the answer was motor cars. Public transit continued its downward spiral. As ridership fell, routes were dropped, property and assets sold off. Finally, local governments bought what was left. They were 15 years too late. For better or for worse, the great American love affair was in full bloom.
Chevrolet, the beautiful shape for 1965. One thing you notice about car commercials, the car is always in a field or by a lake or on an open road with no other car for miles around. It's never caught in a traffic jam.
Below us, the Santa Monica Freeway, also spotted the path of San Pedro.
Ladies and gentlemen, a smog alert is currently in progress. Remain indoors and tune to your local radio station for additional information.
The worst smog of the season, heavy, oppressive, dirty air hung over the city this 4th of July week. It's particularly difficult for the very old and the young.
They seem to only be able to stay outside like maybe 10 minutes at a time. And then they'd have to come inside and rest.
To meet federal pollution standards, the Environmental Protection Agency said today that it might be necessary to remove 8 out of every 10 cars from Southern California's highways during the worst smog months.
I don't know what it's like to not have a car.
You gotta have it. You know, it's a necessity of life. There's not enough public transportation to get you around.
By a vote of 215 to 190, the House today rejected a proposal that would allow cities to spend their share of the Highway Trust Fund on buses, subways, and trains instead of on highways.
The House, defying reason, voted to block funds for mass transit, which we all need, and pour billions more into highways that only the highway lobby wants.
In 1974, with public discontent growing, the Senate Antitrust Committee held hearings about the roots of the transportation crisis.
San Francisco Mayor Alioto testifies at the Senate committee hearing. He is challenged by Senator Roman Huruska of Nebraska.
And I think the automobile industry is the number one example of monopoly power that has changed, literally changed the quality of our lives. And it has done so. Not on the basis of what people really needed, but rather on the basis of serving corporate interests.
Was it General Motors that really wrecked the streetcar system in America?
The answer has got to be yes, because General Motors actually formed the company to go in to buy out these...
General Motors came into a situation where streetcars were inordinately inefficient. They were not flexible. Do you know of any streetcar system that could service San Francisco with all of its outlying communities and suburbs?
I am not an anti-automobile nut. I don't want to outlaw the automobile. I'm not suggesting it isn't a convenient way of traveling. I am suggesting that it must be supplemented by rapid transit systems. And I cannot accept the argument that rapid transit systems broke down because of their complete inefficiency to serve the public, because the experience of Western Europe and Japan belies that argument. And finally, Senator, I must say, with great deference, that if it is true that the streetcar companies were breaking down of their own weight, why was it necessary for General Motors to join with Standard Oil and the tire companies to go in and buy the systems and tear up the tracks?
General Motors replies to Mayor Alioto and other critics.
Wholly unfounded accusations have been widely publicized to the damage of General Motors. Street railways failed for economic and demographic reasons, which had nothing to do with any plot. The fact that GM provided a modest amount of financial assistance to National City Lines did not have any effect on National City Lines' decision to convert from streetcars to buses.
The fact remains that here was a breakdown of a system, a mode of transportation, and in came the bus. Now, you can't get away from buses, can you?
I'm not trying to get away from buses. Well, let me emphasize again
that we... I thought you were trying to eliminate General Motors and
that
the bus.
All I want is balance, Senator. And you ought not to treat the automobile with $15 billion of favor a year and treat everything else like an orphan child. What's good for General Motors is not necessarily good for the country. And in the field of transportation, what has been good for General Motors has in fact been very, very bad for the country.
For a time after the Senate hearings in 74, public transportation staged a partial comeback. After years of pressure, Congress finally allowed highway trust funds to be used for transit improvements. Several cities canceled highway projects. San Francisco and Washington put the money into new subways. And many cities began developing plans for light rail, the modern term for streetcars. 25 cities are now experimenting with light rail systems. They cost less than highways, pollute less, and bring new life to city centers. But the auto and highway lobby has different ideas about what America needs.
America is one of the few countries in the world whose people have always been free to come and go as they please. Now that freedom is being threatened. But what can frustrated drivers do about it? Launch a program.
The highway lobby may have lost some of its 1950s luster, but it's still powerful. It has recently pushed through Congress a plan for a second national highway system with four times the miles of the interstates. And long range, launch a program coordinated. And in the cities where people just won't allow another lane to be added, the highway lobby has developed a new approach. In 1989, the Highway Users Federation formed the Intelligent Vehicle Highway Society. Now, every vehicle can replace older. Its idea? Automate cars and highways. Computers would control chains of cars traveling 60 miles per hour, bumper to bumper. The hope? Double or even triple the number of cars on the road. Drivers need to know. This cyber system will require hundreds of new technologies.
Jim, this is Sony's new in-vehicle navigation system. It incorporates two different technologies, GPS, which is the global positioning system of satellites, and CD-ROM.
Well, what we have here, Jim, is a TRW, electronically controlled electric powered steering unit, or EPS. But think about this. Next generation electric powered steering systems could become a key component for hands-off steering as part of the automated highway systems of tomorrow.
This may sound like some futuristic fantasy, but the highway lobby has found powerful allies in the computer and information industries. 90% of federal funding for transportation research now goes to intelligent vehicle projects. If this cyber scheme ever becomes reality, it will cost some $200 billion. Mm-hmm. If Alfred Sloan were alive today, he'd love Los Angeles. With the old rail lines gone, more people drive cars here than anywhere else in America. Those who don't depend on a badly overburdened bus system.
Transportation is an issue, especially in our community. We know that 90% of the ridership on the buses are low-income residents. The job centers get further and further away from where we live. And because the lack of services in our community, we have to go so far to get groceries.
It's so crowded at times, the bus passes people by.
It's been many times I've been at the bus stop and two or three of the buses passed me by that I walk back home and call someone for a ride.
It's just not a good system at all.
All over America, public transit is in crisis. Federal operating support, an important piece of every system's budget, has been sliced practically in half. At the same time, highway funding continues to grow. Philadelphia is one city that's been badly hurt.
This proposal is the most comprehensive cutback that we can ever recall being proposed.
I drive 15 miles to the Parkersburg train station, and if that station is closed, I'm not driving 30 miles to the next closest train station.
Louis Gambaccini, director of SEPTA, Philadelphia's Public Transportation Authority.
Our backs are to the wall. We've had to cut 10% out of our budget, $65 million. We've squeezed in every possible direction, and we're really down to the very last resort. I don't want to do it. I think it's a terrible mistake, and I think we'll pay a dear price later for it.
One of the many cuts the city has had to make, four trolley lines have been terminated. Philly has worked hard to hold on to the streetcars left by National City, but now the ghosts of General Motors and the Fitzgeralds may finally have their way.
A big streetcar garage in Philadelphia. Bob Hughes is maintenance manager.
This shop will be closed. The plug is pulled, and it's only a matter of two more weeks, and we'll be out of business. And then they give us 2 weeks to actually get rid of everything and shut the place down. 2091 was brought in today for an inspection.
You're doing the inspection?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. As far as I'm concerned, we're running streetcars until the 12th of September. And my job is to maintain those streetcars in a safe manner until the 12th of September. And on the 11th of September, I'll be inspecting streetcars.
Well, they're saying that in 3 years, they're going to put back on the track these cars.
Well, if you believe that, then you believe Chrysler's going to bring back the DeSoto. And I don't think they are.
It's called a spiral unto death. You cut back service, you lose passengers, you lose revenue, you lose the confidence of your ridership that you can be effective and meet their needs. This is happening all over the country. Over half of the transit operators are needing to either raise fares, cut service, or do both.
I would like to give people a choice. I'd like them to be able to have their automobiles, but I'd like them to also be able to have a meaningful choice in the use of transit. And they don't have that choice right now.
The only good transportation you can have in cities, in modern cities, is the one that combines public transportation, private transportation, which treats pedestrians decently and uses often bicycles and has a diversity of modes. When everybody drives, the system collapses.
Former San Francisco Mayor Alioto.
When cities get to the point where you have nothing but stop and crawl traffic, obviously there isn't going to be any urban delight. There isn't going to be delight of the things that make a city what it is. And therefore, mass transit has to be continued, improved, and expanded. It's vital to the health of the city. It's vital to the beauty of the city. It's vital to the quality of life that the city has.
We're here early in the first step of a long-term campaign to bring mass transit and public transit to the public.
we've had quite a few demonstrations at the Board of Supervisors. In fact, one of the meetings had more than 1,000 people at it. You know, if nobody's talking, if nobody's saying anything, then people may think, oh, well, it's something that will blow over. It's something we can't change. But if people begin to think about it, people begin to talk about it, then they think they can change it. And that's where we make a difference, I think.
This is a critical moment, critical moment. I would say in the next 5 years, these 5 years will determine whether there will be a viable transit systems in over half of the areas of this country.
And with some very cool jazz by Delfeo Marsalis, we end Taken for a Ride. That last remark on the film, that we have maybe 5 years to save public transportation, that was made by the director of Oakland, California's transit system. Let's hope she's wrong, because this film was made in 1996. Yeah, that's 20 years ago, but of course, nothing has changed since then. Thank you for listening to New World Notes. You'll find an archive of all our shows on the web at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, advising illegitimi non-carborundum, be kind to your web-footed friends, speak truth to power, and please come back again next week. Ciao.